Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want hope and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm Eric. Before we get started, remember to check out all of our podcasts of this show at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app. Today, we have Ned Ryan Doyle, who spent an illustrious career working on projects and advocating for sustainable energy. Ned was on a while back, and we had a really good show where we talked about how easy it was to install solar panels, and we talked about the energy industry and what we could be doing to advocate for sustainable energy. And I wanted to bring him back because he's a self-taught expert in what people can do to reduce our carbon footprint. And I think he can provide some real-life examples for us for how to reduce our carbon footprint. So the question I've had over the summer amid, you know, fire and flooding and things like that was, actually the odd thing is a movie came to mind, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And I thought, you know, transportation is a big part of this. And, you know, in fact, I did a little digging and 29% of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions comes from transportation. And within transportation, that includes cars and trucks and yes, planes and yes, trains. So let's talk about that. Welcome, Ned.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. I'm looking forward to our conversation here. You can be Steve Martin and I'll be John Candy for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
I'm just not that funny.
Well, the topic isn't actually that funny, but we have to find humor where we can these days. And there might be a tad of it in this conversation. The whole idea of trying to address the transportation in terms of climate, in terms of the economics and the social impacts of it, it gets pretty complicated. So I think that's important to come out of the chute. And Planes, Trains, Automobiles includes a lot more than just that, you know, catchy intro to it.
Right.
And it's...
So let's break it down. What's in there? Let's talk about what you would include in there, and that'll help us get to where we need to be.
Well, we could do it a couple of different ways. I think the simplest way right out of the chute here, just start with the planes, because the plane contribution, aircraft contribution to climate change and a lot of these issues per capita, per mile traveled, is the worst. It's the heaviest. It's the most inefficient way to do it. And we go down the whole line there. But fortunately, in the context of relativity with all our problems, it's a small fraction. It varies depending on who studies and what kind of miles you're measuring and so forth. But it runs about 1.5 to maybe 3% of that 30% that you mentioned. Forgive me, but I rounded off. If somebody says 29.7, it's 30%. So while airline industries and transportation by air is extremely inefficient, it needs to be addressed. It's not the biggest part of the problem.
Right.
Even if we completely, if nobody flew, we really would be not that far ahead of the game. There's no excuse for it. And I want to be quick to say there was a lot of effort in the industry for biofuels for planes, electric motors, other alternatives to improve this the carbon footprint and so forth. So that's all really good right there. We have to be aware of it. With that in mind, not to ignore it, not to forget it, but kind of put the planes to the side, because that's not really the core of our problem. The core of our problem comes in far more in terms of that full 30% with the trains and the cars.
Well, what else is there?
Well, that's where some of the humor comes. It doesn't really have much to do with rail and trains in the United States. Now, let's be clear with that. We'll come back to that. In the United States, trains are a equivalent, very, very efficient as to anywhere else in the world. The miles traveled, the energy per mile and so forth, the passenger, all that. What passenger trains we have right now, and primarily just up and down the East Coast, are very efficient. They're packed every day. They do the great job. However, the United States, America really hates trains. Almost everything shipped and moved in the United States is done by truck, as well as passenger vehicles for cars. But the upshot of that is the trains are very, very underutilized in the United States. We are relying all, I think it's something like 90 to 95% of all the produce, not product, but products and raw materials and so forth that are shipped around the country are done by truck. You know,
so we're not going to talk about planes, trains, and automobiles. We're going to talk about planes, trucks,
trains, and automobiles. trucks and trains that kind of do the same thing, and that's why I lump them together.
Right. Okay. What's important for folks, though? So trucks are going to be part of this conversation.
Oh, the trucks were a huge part of the conversation because of obviously of the impact they have just burning the diesel fuel, the gasoline, whatever, right. It's exacerbated by the fact that unlike the rest of the world, we really don't have a rail system that's nationwide. So the argument, which you'll find, thank a trucker for the meal on your table. Well, yeah, it's true. They do a hard work. It's tough, all that, but it's a lot cheaper to do it by train. Now, I throw that out there, and we'll come back to some of this later. When we look at what raw materials and what is being transported around the country by the existing train system itself, and I'm not talking commercial passengers, but coal is one of the biggies. Well, it's the cheapest, easiest way to move coal. Coal companies are not hiring trucks to bring coal to the coal-fired power plants. It comes in on a train because it's cheap, it's effective, efficient,
so
and it's easy.
That doesn't work for products that you order from Amazon or in the grocery store. So, and if you're on the highway, you see all the trucks. So it's easy to understand that trains are more efficient if they can deliver your goods to you locally from a coal mine. That doesn't change the fact that trucks are a major component of transportation and fossil fuel emissions.
As the system is designed today, yes. But if the train, we don't have a train system, so it's a false equivalent. You know, I get excited about it because it's like, well, yeah, if no one has a car away, we all have to walk there. Well, yeah, but we don't have trains to speak of hauling very much at all. I think it was from the EPA estimates that if 25% of the products that we're shipping around now by truck went about 750 miles on a train and then were unpacked into a truck, it would be about a 75% savings for the climate and the cost and so forth of those goods because they went on the train. And so when we look at what you mentioned, the China products, and I get that, I know that, that shipping container comes in from China, wherever, lands at LAX in the harbor and the port, and it's the big container booms, take them off, load them up. They're not being, there's a line in that, but they're not being loaded on trains to be sent to Chicago and then distributed, or onto trains to go to Houston and be distributed, or on trains to get to New York and be distributed. And I give all those examples because that's what the benefit and the beauty of a train system is to get these goods and so forth closer to the final destination, wherever it may be. And then, yeah, you're going to use trucks to you're not going to have a train going door to door, but if you can get a train stopping in major cities in each state, all of a sudden, boom, the fuel consumption goes down, the efficiency goes way up. We've got more reliability. We have, to an extent, a good bit more protection from things like the dock shutdowns and supply chain issues. It's just a matter. We run out of diesel fuel or the truckers go on strike. Well, that's the end of it.
Well, so
we got to wait till it's done.
It sounds like, and we definitely will get to this, is build a better train system and you'll use trucks less. So let's talk for a minute about the impact of those trucks on global emissions, because I think that's a big contributor to the fossil fuel emissions and climate change. So tell us a little bit about trucks.
Well,
that you want to replace with trains.
The trucks we're using now, I'm trying to keep it in context and relative to what's going on, are getting slightly more efficient than they have been. They're getting a bit cleaner with the highway regulations and the EPA emissions and so on. So they're getting a little bit better than they have been previously. Now, I looked into this and I'm open for more information, correction, and I will, you know, wave the flag if I'm way off. But the emissions from trucks and industrial transportation of this nature is a ballpark of half of all the transportation emissions we're seeing when we include the passenger trucks or passenger cars and pickups and, you know, civilian residential type of thing. It's hard to break it down because there's so many categories,
right?
So many distinctions. Somebody says, well, no, this is the four-wheel drive SUVs, so that's the truck.
We're talking about long-haul truckers, not, you know, the F-150.
Exactly. The Kenworths.
Yeah,
the
Peterbilt's
out there. Exactly, yeah. To get those numbers. It's a ballpark, a half.
Right.
Where all this fuel is getting burned up. So in terms of the climate and in terms of the economics, it's definitely a target. It's definitely something to be looked at. And one way to address, you know, I'm not saying get rid of all the trucks. You know, it's absurd. It's not going to happen. But as it's developing, they could be electric as well, that right away. And one of the, and I find very legitimate, criticisms of the electric truck for hauling, you know, the Peterbilt, the Kenworth, the big ones like that. It's like, well, you can't drive from New York to LA with one battery. Well, that's true. Where I'm getting to with this is that last stage. If you get the goods shipped to Chicago, just pull a city, well, an electric truck, a great big electric truck with only a 500-mile range does a really, really good job of delivering it that next step into the community. So rethinking what we have for the transportation system is a big aspect of where we're at right now.
Right. So one more thing on the trucks. What would it take to make the trucking industry more efficient? And I'm going to give you a little hint where I'm going is, let's say you can put a battery on a big truck. You don't lose any power. You can still get where you're going. It's got a 500-mile radius. What's required to make that happen?
Not much. Truth be told, the technology is here. It's emerging. And I know that's kind of a slippery word in some ways, but it's here.
Do we have enough charging stations? And with that, maybe segue into cars as well. So in other words, do we have enough charging stations for the trucks if we wanted to go that route? But then that raises the same question for cars.
Yes and no. Well, no, if you imagine tomorrow all the trucks magically turned electrical, no, it would be up the creek. Nothing would get moved. But just like EVs for the passenger vehicle cars, just like the electric vehicles that the residential and citizens and passenger cars are using these days, the charging stations are expanding almost exactly at the pace as the adoption of the vehicles are coming up. So we can't get a truck. Well, you can charge your EV at home now. There are loads of public places, and it's matching the demand. And so, you know, one of the legitimate arguments, and this is also one used by the trucking industry now, is like, well, we can't do electric trucks because there's no charging stations. Well, you got a point there. A couple more trucks, a couple more charging. And fortunately, with the charging on trucks, it's easier in that you know where the trucks are going to be. They're right along the highway. You've got access to all these facilities. And, you know, a trucker going from New York to L.A. is not going to be pit stopping in Butte, Montana. They're going to be on the highway.
Right.
So you know where the bulk of them are going
to
be.
And that reminds me of something we've already got, which is the gas station, which is if you go to most gas stations on any long road trip, you can get your gas for your car. There's also diesel for the truck at the same spot. So there doesn't seem like there's any reason you couldn't just have the same kind of approach.
And more and more with EV chargers at the same.
Yeah, right.
Right.
So let's talk for a quick minute because we got to the planes and the trains and even the trucks. We didn't talk about cars and we all drive cars. So what's your take there?
Well, we come back to a few ingrained issues, such as it's not the same, but it's along the lines of refusing to have a train system. Back in the 50s or so, the idea of urban, suburban, and rural in community, city, town development was all the rage. Because after all, gas was 10 cents a gallon. It was perfectly cheap, completely clean, an infinite supply. There was no reason not to build cities the way we've done them. And the upshot today, we've noticed a few of those claims didn't really pan out in terms of cheap and clean and infinite. But what we have now is the remnants of that, where for a large portion of the folks, you're forced to drive around. There's a full circle cycle coming where walkable cities and local, garden, grocery stores and so forth, coming back to that closer to a village idea. But for most people, how many people listening to the show now drive to work? I don't know, but we don't know
anymore because of the pandemic changed all that a little bit.
Let's say it's only 50% because folks are working at home. I can commit that. But that's a lot of people. It's amazing to me because, oh, I got a great new job. And, good for them. It's only an hour commute either way. And it pays. Okay, so you got an hour in the morning, an hour and back. $3.50 a gallon for gas. How many miles? It doesn't make sense,
right?
When you spread it out over the whole community,
and when you spread out over a city, the irony of all of that to me is people don't like to sit in traffic, and they complain about traffic, and they complain about other drivers, and then they do just what you said, which is I just got a new car or a new job, and it's an hour away, and you end up sitting in that car going nowhere. Hopefully listen to a great talk show like this. It's a disconnect. And I think we're going to end up talking about that disconnect a little bit more. What would you say to that?
I would say I'm looking forward to the conversation.
We all love our cars. We like to go on road trips. We like to listen to the radio in the car, and we're more comfortable being in charge when we drive places, but we also sit in traffic, and it's because we like to drive. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. The first thing I want to ask you is, when we think about, let's start with the trucks and the cars, what are the common barriers to full sale adoption of basically battery powered and charging stations?
Well, I would say the two biggest barriers, and they're not really that big, are the economics of it and the availability. The availability in terms of passenger vehicles is not really, I'm trying to choose the words carefully. It's not unlimited, but if you want to go and buy an electric vehicle, you've got a good number of sources and a good number right off the showroom floor to pick them up. It's not really a challenge.
Are they affordable?
That is the other side of the coin. And it depends on an individual's economic situation that we can define affordable. And how we do that math matters. It's an old saying, but it's true. Some people just have to ride the bus. Others can get a Rolls Royce. So we're somewhere on that spectrum. And just like, even if it was an internal combustion engine, an ICE vehicle, forget about the electric part, not a lot of people can just walk in and drop $35,000 down to go walk away with a car. It doesn't matter how it's run.
Right.
You're just not going to happen. So the fact that the prices of the vehicles floats around, there's so many models, but you're looking at probably a bottom, I think the Chevy Volt, a couple of them are a little, but $25,000 on up for an electric vehicle. Don't anybody hold me to it, because it depends on so many factors, but $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, people will go and buy a Chevy Tahoe or whatever. I'm not picking on them. Drop all that money on it. They lose 10 grand driving off the lot. Then you're talking thousands every year for insurance and gas and repairs and maintenance and so on. So how you do this math matters. Now, not everyone is going to be able to afford like $30,000 for some of the passenger EVs is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But with financing, a huge number of people can. And you think about this, and it's a strong parallel with the automotive industry as we've known it. There would be no one would have all these cars. No one would have all these dreams. We wouldn't be building a highway if there was no finance. But it's not as easy to just finance an EV. It's like solar panels. It's just more of a battle.
So why is that? Here's my question. If I'm considering changing my family dynamic and, we're ready to get a new car, and it's probably going to be, was an SUV, maybe a van, and I want to switch, and explain to me why it would be more expensive and more difficult to get financing for my new EV car as opposed to another SUV.
From what I've gathered, I can tell you why I personally haven't hit all the dealers. The dealers will have some financing available when you go in there. So
right.
It's not as if you can't get it, but the finance you get from a dealer is typically not the best deal you're going to get. So now, if you look elsewhere, they're not used to it. They just don't have it. It's, oh, you want to get a F-150? Okay, we plenty of loans out. You want to get a VW Passat? We got loads out. You want a new what? And there's a resistance built into it. It's you can overcome it. But it's in there. So that's one part. And another reason that the economics come into play that most people to this point haven't really absorbed is how much less expensive it is to maintain the electric vehicle. Not just the fuel cost. The fuel cost is like, it floats around, but it's like 2 to 3 cents a mile is usually the number people give. And, you know, divide that into 350 a gallon, you know, and something that gets 18 miles to the gallon, and all you don't have to be a mathematician to realize it's pretty good. But in addition to the mileage, the cost per mile to move the car, there's a huge number of typical normal things you expect. Oil changes and a full electric, you don't have to bother with it. The moving parts of an engine, you still have brakes and so on and so forth. So there's wear and tear, I'm saying that. But in terms of routine maintenance, it goes down to negligible.
So let me ask you this.
The point only being that saves a huge amount on an annual basis, fuel and maintenance,
right,
for having an EV, which in effect, accounting-wise, is applied to what you're paying every month,
right,
because you got that much extra money.
Right. So let's say I want to buy a new car. I don't want a Prius or a Volt. I want something that's more substantial. Like I'm used to, I've got my SUV. I'm ready to replace it with an EV. And it sounds like what you're saying is there are economic reasons over time to go with the EV. Are EVs, let's just take the SUV example or a light truck example. Do they cost the same as a gas powered, same type of car? Off the lot. I'm not talking about long term. I'm just talking about.
It's kind of an apples and oranges question. They're comparable. I'll say that. You can easily find a price match if you cross back and forth between cars and models and SUVs. So you can get really close. But what are the amenities? What are the extra features? The add-ons are a huge. If you've got a bare bones price, so that you can work with it. Be like, well, yeah, but I really want to see,
right,
and then it goes up. So it's really hard to, but it's very, very close at this point. I think if it really boiled it down and really fought everything, the EVs today are, gosh, it's so hard not, I would say they're 5 to 10% maybe more expensive vehicle to vehicle if you're trying to match them up in a certain sense out of the chute from the dealer. They'll be a little bit more, but again, you get what you pay for. Right. So those prices are still coming down.
Right.
Tesla had a kind of fire sale or whatever, I forgot which model. Plus, at the same time, this is important, used EVs are coming onto the market.
Right. So
that price goes down even farther.
So there is a bit of an adoption cycle, as with everything.
Absolutely.
And it starts with most things at the higher end, and then it trickles down, and it feels a little bit like we're getting to that point. I just want to kind of narrow the conversation a little bit. We've talked about the possibility of using trains more than we are. We've talked about going more EV on heavy duty trucks, long haul trucking. And now we're talking about the adoption of EV cars. So let's focus on those. Pick one. What are the barriers to adoption of any of those that you would want to focus on?
There are really no barriers in my mind, with the exception of if your intention is to do nothing but drive around the United States hither and yon and travel the by roads, the back roads, and do nothing else, you're going to have a problem because you're not quite enough charging stations everywhere for everybody. But normal people doing normal things for most of the time really don't have any barrier to it. You can put chargers in your home. There's public charging. Lots of workplaces have the charging. lots of retail areas have the charging now as well, kind of like free Wi-Fi. Well, they charge for the electricity. So I'm taking that off as far as being a barrier. But
so what are we doing? I mean, if we're at a point where it's clear that climate change is having an impact, you just have to watch the news and the weather. And yet the adoption, it sounds like for at least cars, it could be there. It's just go out and get one, go shift, go trade in your car. What's going on? Are there political barriers? Is it about us? Are we not making the decision to just go and do this? Do we not know the facts? Like you said, are we not thinking about it long term? What's slowing it down?
All of the above. The transition aspect from ICE to EVs, internal combustion.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
It's a natural phenomenon. I really wouldn't call it a barrier. To some of us, we know that electric vehicles have been around for over 100 years. You know, they were knocked out because of oil and gas, and that's why they took out the trolleys and all that. So it's not a new idea. But in terms of the general public and those not into history and science and, you know, what's happening, it's a new phenomenon. And it's human nature, I think, to say, you know, you say, well, gee, we bought this car just 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and it's still pretty nice, you know, and the kids haven't ran it into a tree or anything. You know, do we really want to sell it and take a chance on these newfangled cars? And that's understandable. You know, so there's a little hesitant, but when the time comes, I've seen numerous consumer surveys, and there've been some of them around this area, is that the flipping point for a lot of people, most people it seems, is when they need to get a new car, when they're ready to buy, then, you know, it comes home to them that now we're going to look at the car, and that is happening. We're seeing that left and right. EV adoption rates are relatively skyrocketing. It's just going crazy. It's great. In that way, it's a matter of time. But I think in terms of the bigger question here with transportation, where we are now, we should hit on some of the basic things people need to be doing right now. Even if you're driving a gas hog, no matter what you're driving, if you plan the trips, you're going to save money. You're going to save gas. It's as simple as that. If you don't have to drive around, don't. Well, I've been doing it for years, and it makes a huge difference.
Well, describe it.
Well, it's where are you going, and what's the route, and what can you do along the way? So this morning, I'm up here, radio program. Here we are. And when we're done with this, I'm planning to go up to the pharmacy and get my monthly prescription. One small tool I'm hoping to pick up. I should be able to find it on the way back. And then a couple of, well, it's grocery shopping. But it's also right on the way. So I'm combining all four things. And now I to make it even better out of that, because I got to come here anyway. I'm from a 25-mile ride to do all the other errands and then come back. It's not 50 miles. It's probably going to be 55 miles. But instead of three trips, four trips would be two. You know, it's right there. And it works even locally. When you go out, pretend you're not going to have to go out, or you don't want to go out for 2 or 3 days. Get that stuff done at once. And if it's not a critical need, don't go for it until the next time you go out.
So like a driving to-do list.
Yeah, very good. And it's old. I've seen this since the early 70s, people advocating for this. And this, you don't have to be perfect. Just do better than you're doing now. I drive a 2004 Prius. The battery is still at 90%. For my driving, on an average month, it runs ballpark 4 to 5 gallons a month to drive, and that's 250 miles. Right. And that's a busy month.
Well, that's what you were talking about, is that it's not just the price of the car, it's the long stream value of the car over time, and then the incremental, you don't need as much service, the battery just gets recharged. It's a more economical, efficient way to drive, basically. I still think we need some explanation around this desire for folks to have the like car. I mean, I've heard the argument from plenty of people. I don't want to get a car that small. I've got a family. I go on longer road trips. I can't get stuff in the car. So that goes back to the availability of the models of cars that are more flexible than just a passenger car.
Well, look out, get out there and shop. There are bigger RVs, EVs.
Yeah.
Already coming on to provide that need.
Right.
And
your point is about that is they may be a little bit more expensive. However, you have to factor it over time and that you're not going to be paying as much in gas, servicing, oil change, things like that. So you can't just factor in the price of the car at the lot.
Well, that's what the ICE advocates do. They just stop it right there.
Right.
It's like saying, well, solar is more expensive than natural gas. Well, no, not if you count free energy. It's a whole lot cheaper than natural gas. And to address that, what is a person have for specific transportation needs? Ask themselves that. Are we calling rocks? You know, are you a stonemason? It ain't going to cut it to drive a Prius.
That's what I'm saying. Is people do that to a degree.
Yeah. And, you know, so that, and there's many variations on it. But if most of your transportation needs are going to be within like a 50-mile range, you go to work closer, the kids go to school, you're not going big distance, an EV is fine.
Right.
And if you say, well, you know, my folks or friends or family live in Oregon, we go every summer, we go to visit Chicago, every winter we go to, you know, Houston, whatever. You don't need to have a car year round for that. And now I'm not advocating for burning fossil fuels, but it's cheaper to rent a car for a week for a vacation than it is to own it all year long and get 8 miles to the gallon out of the thing.
So
strategy comes into play as well.
If we can shift over for a minute to this trains and trucks conversation, what we had talked about is on one hand, we can do long haul trucking. We can put batteries in the trucks. We can have more charging stations, just like we have plenty of gas stations on the highway. We just have to go and do that. But the other side of it is we can reduce the trucking if we have a more extensive transportation system for cargo, for trains. Explain a little bit more about why we don't do that.
Well, the starting point would be take a look at the European Union. We can't do that on the radio, so trust me on this one. But for those of you that are inclined to be able to do a DuckDuckGo search or one of the big guys, pull up graphics of train lines in Europe and the train lines and network in the United States and compare them. Now, I've seen a number of these, so I know that they're out there. It's a plate of spaghetti dumped on the European Union, and it's a couple of real skinny lines cutting across the United States. And yes, we can make the long haul truckers electric. I mean, and that's going to happen to an extent because we need electric trucks. End of conversation. But if we're talking climate change, if we're talking efficiency, if we're talking fossil fuels, it is exponentially more efficient to build out a legitimate rail system for the long haul than it is to build all the trucks to go electric.
But is that going to be expensive to put in new tracks? And
how expensive will it be to change all the trucks over to? Yes, it is. It would be expensive. Okay, so there's no argument there whatsoever. But it's an investment. It's not an expense. And this is language here I think is really critical for folks to understand. It's an investment. I'm going to use it as example again, when you buy solar panels and put them on your house, it's an investment as well as an expense. Not only do they pay you back, you keep the value when you sell the house, it's an investment. And so when we look at the rail system, Europe and the rest of the world, Europe just has done the best job, but Europe has invested in a rail system that is extremely efficient. Ask anybody who's had the Europass. The trains are everywhere, and it is dramatically more efficient. So we have to fundamentally rethink why we don't have a train system. And when we get to that point, do it. Now, even with a completely excellent train system like they have in the European Union, they have trucks at the end of the station to right. pick the stuff up. So, people go, oh, you get rid of all the trucks. And nobody, well, no, nobody's saying that.
Right.
Reduce the number of trucks, reduce the system, and there's a transition period.
Well, it's a lot easier to put a battery on a UPS truck or an Amazon truck driving around town than it is a long haul truck. So you're basically taking out a lot of the...
I would disagree with that. There's the technology of it is equivalent. There is certainly scale, and there are technical aspects, yes, but essentially there's no difference. But let's go. Why convert 2 million trucks to electric when you only need to convert 500,000?
Right.
And that number's way low. But you see it. So say the money you save not going electric for trucks hauling long distance pays for the rails.
So
I'm
going to bring up a point closer to the end, but I want to bring something up. We haven't talked about a barrier being policy or a government. We haven't really talked about barriers being either the automotive industry or the trucking industry or the energy industry. Are they standing in the way of this, like a lot of people think? Should we be charging BlackRock and Vanguard and dragging folks into the street?
Well, you've got my interest now.
Well, it's an important point. We talked about was just do it. We can just do it. We have to change our mindset. We can do it. But are there real barriers? Oh,
there absolutely are. And I hedged on that earlier when you asked about the technical barriers. For all practical purposes, with the exception of aviation fuel, there are no technical barriers, period, to going green, EVs, transportation, and all that. However, policy and politics are definitely barriers. We all have industries and interests that are making unpronounceable, unimaginable amounts of money off the current situation the way it is right now. And a little tidbit I picked up last night, kind of getting some notes together for this, approximately 10% of people, the wealthy at the top, are responsible for 40% of emissions. And of that number, about 1% to 5% are responsible about half of those. It's an extraordinary, there's a huge difference here in terms of wealth and disparity that's going on. And I bring that up because, you know, Eric, if you were making $1 million a minute, you would stall for another day and get used to it.
Well, how does that translate into carbon emissions?
Well, selling more fossil fuels, we didn't even mention boats, floating on yachts, flying their airplanes, building these huge mansions, supporting their investments in cars and natural gas, coal, fire power plants. People with that kind of money don't really walk anywhere. They get private jets, private airplanes, private yachts.
But wouldn't anybody do that? And I'm just playing a little bit of devil's advocate in here. Anyway, it's so they've amassed this wealth. Wouldn't anybody want to enjoy that? Or are they just off the rails, so to speak, in terms of their spending?
Totally off the rail. No.
Way more than they need.
But you're looking at people who have 100 million into the billions, and to them say, oh yeah, another airplane. I'd like the green one this time. And we have to ask, and it's related to this. Why, for what reason, do we justify one person being worth $50 billion or $30 billion, whatever the number, the top 10 list, it goes back to, we're allowing this to go on because it is, it's part and parcel, this problem of essentially unchecked, unregulated capitalism. We see it with Citizens United, with the money in politics. We see it with this concentration of wealth at the very top, at the same time as the people at the bottom are going hungry, they're going cold in the winter, they're hot in the summer, They're fighting for food. They don't have housing, the home. All this is going on while a handful of people have more money than they can even count. And so we come back. How does that connect?
Well, so
they don't care about carbon emissions. It doesn't make any difference to them. That's not my job. I'm just making the money. And it's the same sort of a parallel thinking for policy and government, which is owned. Nobody can tell us otherwise. It's owned by the corporations. It's owned by the rich. It's probably the only thing in America that everybody will agree on.
So
that the 1% are running the show in the government. You may not, the end result will be different.
Right. But we got to this point with a conversation about planes, trains, and automobiles, which is, it's important. Everything's connected. And you get to a point where there's a disparity. And it seems like the concept of a disparity pops up on the show all the time. And this one is driven by, if you have more money, you're going to consume more fossil fuels and therefore contribute to climate change. And there's a huge disparity in that, because I feel like the people who are most affected by climate change are the ones who don't use a lot of fossil fuels because they can't afford to in the first place a lot of times. Now, just use an example, as if you're poor, you take public transportation, you don't drive your car everywhere, you don't put solar panels on your house, you may not be able to use air conditioning or heating. Climate change, you could almost argue, from a fossil fuel perspective, from a transportation perspective, that's also who orders the most stuff delivered to their home that comes on trucks. You could almost argue that, and I'm not talking about the 1%, I'm talking about anybody who has cash to spend is contributing to climate change.
I would not go so far as that. As loath as I am to attach numbers to these conversations, no, I wouldn't quite agree with that just because they have money. And I'll say up to $1 million, okay? I've met some very, very responsible, pretty close to millionaires.
Right, okay.
That are aware of this, that have what I would call a responsible footprint for their wealth commitment. They're not egregious on it. So many things you brought up. It's not just your feeling. It's a fact, Eric. So relax on it's a feeling. It's not. This is the fact. Just throwing it out there. The low-income people can spend 25 to 35% regularly of their income on energy in a trailer. When you have $1 million or, $100, it's like, oh, that's petty cash.
My point is there's responsibility across the spectrum. If you're willing to buy a car, a new car that's not an EV car, and use it to sit in traffic, you're making a choice. And that choice is connected to climate change. Yes. You don't have to be Jeff Bezos to do that.
Yes.
That just means you can afford a car. Full stop. You're making a choice to not get an EV. And I think that was my point. It wasn't to say that, we should let the super wealthy off the hook. I think that it's clear that they do overspend. But I think that it's the lack of thinking of everybody else, perhaps, of that they do a similar thought process. If I can afford to do something, if I can afford to get more packages, I'm going to bring them. If I can go out again, like you were saying, and not plan a trip, I'm not going to think about it, and I'm going to go and do that. So my point is it's beyond just because they're rich. It's they are making a choice, and it is an irresponsible choice, and I'm with you on that. But it trickles down. That goes to my point is, I don't know that we should blame all of us and say we're all contributing this, but we all are. The point is, what can we do to be more responsible?
Well, there's intentional contribution and there's unavoidable. Cold in the winter, you got to turn the heat on. Right. Don't give me stuff. And that's a good point. And as critical as I am, and I'm open about it, this distribution of wealth issue and so forth, there's a few rich people that do some good stuff. We look at, I'm just a couple, what's her name? Taylor Swift, the young lady that's running. I'm the only one in the universe that doesn't know, apparently. Who knows how many hundreds of millions she made, but she gave $1 million or something, $100,000 to each one of the roadies on the tour.
Right.
For that. It's a staggering amount, but that was a good thing. What's his name? Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
He does this stuff all the time. How many football players, and I see many, are buying homes and paying things off for the kids in their neighborhood
right.
to go back and do it. There's a lot. But if you're sitting on however many, and it's like you could do more. Bill Gates has his foundation, and so far it's squandered something along the line, and I may be wrong, something just a little bit over, maybe under 1% of his wealth.
One of the things that comes to mind is really this idea of long-term thinking. And as I was listening to the show, as we were doing the show, the thing that kept coming to mind was this idea of long-term thinking that involves a few things. We have to look at things like their investments, whether it's investing in new train systems, whether it's investing in a car because it's going to be more efficient over time, whether it's going to be planning our trips. I mean, all of these things are about investing, thinking long-term. And with that also is this idea of being responsible with your footprint. And I think, candidly, we do a lot of bashing of the rich. And I think a lot of it is very, very fair. The issue I have, though, is that really it's being responsible and encouraging them or demanding that they're responsible. But in a lot of cases, we do the same thing. And we should be responsible. In my opinion as well, we should be responsible. I mean, Ned, you've got an EV. So you took it and put it on your own shoulders to go, I don't like this situation, and took advantage of it. So I think the big theme of planes, trains, and automobiles today was long-term thinking, planning, think of things as an investment, and be responsible. And Ned, do you have something to say?
The last word, so that could be a show title or what? Yes, it's all an investment. And it's an investment in our kids and grandchildren and future generations. It's not instantaneous this quarter accounting. It's looking at the long term. And when we do that, that changes a whole lot. And yes, looking forward, at one point there was a question, well, Ned, what makes you an expert? To paraphrase Isaac Newton, I have stood upon the hood of many a car if I do see farther than others. It's all common sense. It's right. All right here. And we can do this together. We fail together. We can succeed together. But it's an investment in the future and the kids. And if you want the money tomorrow, sorry, pal.
Right.
But if you care about your children, the grandchildren, this is what it's all about.
Thank you. Absolutely. Ned, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Folks, check out all of our podcasts of this show and blog at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app. Dreamers and Doers with Carol Anders is next. Have a great day, everybody.